Hello, and thank you for listening to the Mapping the Zone podcast, a podcast that is normally dedicated to in-depth discussions of the work and context of Thomas Pynchon. But if you were able to catch our sort of teaser for this a couple of months ago, you will remember that we are introducing a new side series to go along with the main episodes for Against the Day that will continue to appear on the feed. So if you're listening to this and you've missed our announcement, don't worry, the Against the Day episodes are not going anywhere. They're not going anywhere for at least another like year and a half. This is just something else that you guys can listen to if you're interested, to kind of provide a bit more variety or kind of topics of discussion beyond just sort of continually moving through that 1,200 page masterwork. Cody, do you want to just give a brief explanation of what we'll be doing for those who may have missed the kind of teaser episode?
So for those who did miss, we are gluttons for punishment, I guess, and decided that it wasn't enough to spend 3 years covering one 1,000-page plus book. We ought to just do another one in between episodes of that. Mm-hmm. And so we decided that with the upcoming anniversary of Infinite Jest, which should be on the day that this actually comes out, we would dive into discussing that one, albeit not as in-depth as we usually do with the Pynchon regular episodes. This will be more broad in the sense that we'll be covering roughly 100 pages at a time over the span of the year. So we won't have as much time to really dive into it like we do with the other episodes, but we'll still be able to talk, you know, as in depth as we can about it and kind of dissect it as much as we can as we go along.
So we wanted to start with sort of a basic overview of who David Foster Wallace is and why we're reading his book, why we're talking about it. Because obviously this show was founded for the purpose of talking about Thomas Pynchon. It will continue to be that primarily for several more years until we get through all of his material. So, you know, with the purpose being to line up with that anniversary kind of settled and out of the way, we wanted to take the first episode of this side series to just talk about the man himself and the work itself before we get into it. And part of this wasn't just to provide some context for the listeners of the show, but also to kind of introduce the book, because in my mind, this is one of those books that is, it's sort of in a modern canon of literature that is always talked about as being important. It's always talked about as being something that you should read. But I don't necessarily think that there is any really solid descriptors of the book itself, what it's about, what it's trying to do, or its author that are out there, to the point where, like, you can listen to some of our takes on this book and different Wallace-related episodes that we've done. But what I have said before is that I kind of approach this book because of that kind of canonized status, as understanding that it was supposed to be really quite good. I don't think I was fully aware of what the book was even about when I opened it, though. Because it kind of defies description in a certain way. I had listened to some interviews with Wallace. I'd watched the end of the tour. So, you know, I know that drugs and tennis were certainly a part of it, but beyond that, not so much as far as actual information. So instead of just kind of throwing everybody in to the deep end, so to speak, we wanted to give this brief sort of primer on the man himself and his book. So we're going to do that in a couple of different ways to try and break down as easily as we can in sort of an efficient as method as possible for you all as you decide to go on this journey with us or not, of who Wallace is and what his book is about. So, Cody, did you want to get into DFW's bio?
Yeah, so I think that's the logical place to start. And this is all just kind of a brief summation of his life, just kind of hitting the main points here. So Wallace was born February 21st of 1962. He grew up in Illinois, graduated from both Amherst College and the University of Arizona. Both of his parents were professors. His father, James, was a philosophy professor. His mother, Sally, was an English professor, which once you've read his work, and especially this one, that makes a lot of sense. The first of his novels, The Broom of the System, was published in 1987 and was essentially just an adaptation and extension of a college thesis that he had done. That one, I have not actually read that one yet. I keep meaning to get around to it, and I just have not gotten to it.
Interesting. It's very
different.
That's
what I hear. He hadn't really fully found his own voice yet, and but it was still, you know, parts of it were there. So yeah, at some point I'll get around to it, and I'm sure I'll enjoy it. He briefly worked as an adjunct professor at Emerson College until he moved to Illinois State, working with the English department there. And then Infinite Jest was published February 1st of 1996. I was looking for some interesting other media that had come out around that time, just to kind of give the listeners a sort of idea of the social and artistic landscape of that time. There is too much. I forgot how absolutely stacked like 1994 to about 1997 was, as far as like art releases between film and music and literature. So I got to the point where I was like, I either have to do nothing, or this is going to become an episode twice as long, and about half of it would be devoted to everything that came out in that time frame. Suffice to say, So we had the first double album in rap history. Tupac's All Eyes on Me was released that year. Sleater Kenny dropped an album. You had there was some major thing with Maverick Records. I think that's when they bought out part of RCA, and ended up owning the rights to a lot of different music at that time, including the Beastie Boys catalog. There was this just in February. Let's see. We had the Tupac album that came out. Chemical Brothers put an album out at that time. Steve Amato, which is a great band. If people haven't listened to them, highly, highly recommend them. Albums came out from the Fugees, The Score. That was a pretty damn big album for that time.
Yeah.
Nick Cave put out Murder Ballads. You had, let's see, Neil Young's soundtrack for Dead Man. Great film, great soundtrack. I was actually just listening to that the other day, too. That actually works as a really good companion source for Against the Day, for anyone who, like me, has to have music on while they read. That soundtrack works really damn well for that that book. What else came out around that time? Of course, Weird Al had an album that came out in that year. Tori Amos put out Boys for Pele, which I go back and forth on whether that's my favorite of her albums or not. Mm-hmm. It's definitely up there. Sleater Kenny's Call the Doctor. Busta Rhymes had The Coming. Neutral Milk's Hotels on Avery Island, which kind of gets lost in the airplane over the sea, but is still a good album in its own. Guided by Voices had an album that came out then. Bikini Kill put out Reject All American. That's just up to April. And this is just music. I haven't even touched the films and the books. So, yeah, suffice to say, a lot of good shit came out in that time, and it made me nostalgic for the 90s. I was in middle school at the time, so that was, like, prime time for me to be into a lot of that music. But Infinite Jest was not on my radar, and wouldn't be for a long time, because I didn't read that until two years ago?
Last
like
year, yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, to get back on track, so Wallace ended up getting a MacArthur Fellowship in 1997, which puts him in the same company as Pynchon, who got the same award in 1988. He then moved to California in 2002 and died by suicide on September 12th of 2008, leaving the manuscript for The Pale King unfinished at the time, which was then collected and assembled by his editor and put out. And I think you and Johan had a pretty good back and forth on that. And then you had that whole separate bonus episode on The Pale King as well.
Yeah.
Which I read and really enjoyed. I'm going to have to go back to it again, obviously, at some point, because there was just so much that was going on in there. But it was a phenomenal book. And then just like as far as recent things, in 2012, an ex-partner of his accused him of having been abusive towards her and others, and more kind of started coming out about that. I thought that should be brought up just in the situation that this kind of thing is still a sort of rampant thing that's coming out, and more of these things are being known. Obviously, we don't have his side of the story on this. And I don't think my I don't want to call it a rule of thumb, but I tend to, with these kind of situations, I have to kind of look at, does that sort of behavior influence their work, their art? And I don't think it does in this case. Like, whether what he's accused of happened, that's, I think, something that would have to have been addressed at that time, but obviously it wasn't. So, but I don't think that, it informs his work in any sort of significant way. I don't think you can, like, especially with who was it we were talking about the other day, that Saul Bellow, where some stuff had come to light about him, and it kind of really shined a light on some of his work and how that those actions that influence his work kind of makes it hard to go back. Yeah, kind of makes it hard to go back and reread that work or to approach it having not read it. But I think with Wallace, you know, assuming it's true, it's a horrible thing to hear about, but I it doesn't really impact my ability to enjoy his work separate from him as a person. We all have our issues and our flaws, and I'm not, you know, obviously not trying to condone any of that, but I don't think that it bled into his work in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, the kind of abbreviated version that I'll give of my explanation of this that I did in the bonus episode on David Foster Wallace as a whole that we've released is sort of twofold. One, that his wife, Karen Green, seems to indicate in speaking about Wallace that he recognized that when he was younger, he had problems with women, in his understanding of you know, women's roles in his life, in society, so on and so forth, and that he really did wrestle with that a fair amount, and that he did seem to accept that he had behaved in ways that were problematic and just plain abusive in the past. So that's one part of it is if his wife is to be believed, which I don't see why you wouldn't, he recognized those issues within himself and did work on himself to try and improve. And then the second thing is he wrote a whole book that you can go read called Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, which is very good, and he talked about the composition of that book on an episode of Bookworm with Michael Silverblatt, where he said that really the genesis of that book was that he recognized that there were some negative impulses in his understanding and treatment of women, and he wanted to try and understand why. And that was the kind of genesis of that writing project as a whole. That is one of his lesser read books, not for any particularly good reason. I think it's quite good, but I think that unlike someone like Saul Bellow, to borrow your example, it would appear as though there was a process by which he understood these things about himself and tried to fix them, a la a Dan Harmon, as opposed as opposed to, you know, a Louis C.K. or a Kevin Spacey or something like that.
That's really all I have as far as his biography. I think from there, moving into his influences would probably be the next logical step.
Yeah.
So, and you know, to sort of preface all of this by saying that I'm clearly not as familiar with his work as you are, but I have been, after reading Infinite Jest for the first time and really having it click for me and kind of just really falling in love with it the way I did, I've kind of gone through and read more about him as a person and his influences and who he influenced subsequently and all that kind of stuff. So I feel, you know, relatively comfortable talking about it. Yeah. The obvious answers here are Pynchon, Don DeLillo, John Barth, William Gaddis. Mm-hmm. I did find a quote from him where he's talking about some of his influence, which I thought was pretty poignant. So I'll read that. He says, historically, the stuff that sort of wrung my cherries, I love that phrase, by the way, Socrates' funeral oration, the poetry of John Donne, the poetry of Richard Cranshaw, every once in a while Shakespeare, although not that often, Keats' shorter stuff, Schopenhauer, Descartes' Meditations on First Philosophy and Discourse on Method, Kant's prolegomena, I probably horribly butchered that, to any future metaphysic, although the translations are all terrible, William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, Wittgenstein's Tractatus, Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, Hemingway, particularly the Ital stuff in Our Time, where you go oomph, Flannery O'Connor, Cormac McCarthy, DeLillo, A.S. Byatt, Cynthia Ozick, the stories, especially one called Levitations, about 25% of the time, Pynchon, Donald Barthelem, especially a story called The Balloon, which is the first story I ever read that made me want to be a writer, Tobias Wolff, Raymond Carver's best stuff, the really famous stuff, Steinbeck when he's not beating his drum, 35% of Stephen Crane, Moby Dick, and The Great Gatsby. Yeah, it's a really interesting combination of influences there, but I think you can see where a lot of those shine through in his work. Yeah. For, you know, I've not read all of those particularly, but the ones I am familiar with, I can definitely see those shining through in his work. I think he's kind of underselling the influence that Pynchon had on him, and I don't know if that's intentional or not. But you know, who knows? I do know he was pretty critical of Vineland, which I think we talked about in either the very first episode of our series on that or the last.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. I thought was a really not really the best take.
No, a pretty bad one.
I get he didn't like it, but I think his explanation of why he didn't like it was a little bit undercooked, which is ironic given his criticism of that book.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think he has a bit more influence from Pynchon than he's admitting to there. But either way, he definitely, he has his own voice. He has his own style. And I don't really know of any other books offhand that are structurally similar to Infinite Jest that I mean, I'm sure you could probably think of something, but, I guess you could point at something like, House of Leaves or something like that with a sort of encyclopedic feel, although that's a much more chaotic by nature than Infinite Jest, but I could see that having been influenced by it.
Yeah, there's a debt to Burroughs there with the cut up novels.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a debt to Barth with some of the ways in which he structured stories in Lost in the Funhouse. There's a debt to Pound trying to sort of organize poetry into logarithmic function. So there's some things that he definitely, from a structural perspective, is. I would say the interesting thing too within that list, and I'm glad that you found it, is that you see sort of, and this will give us kind of a good segue into talking about sort of the major themes of his career, but within that list of influences, you kind of see that there was two halves of his interest and also two halves of kind of his writing career. And the first would be sort of the postmodernists and the black humorists and the sort of deconstructural work that he was really interested in. And then the other is like a lot of just sort of modernism and, for lack of a better term, like earnest, sincere fiction writing. And I say that those two things come together in his work, and we can get into this in a little bit more deeply, but if you hear him sort of give a narrative of his own life, which he does in a couple of different interviews, he certainly gives a lot of this detail in his first interview that he did with Charlie Rose after the publication of A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. He talks about how when he was in college and when he was originally writing, he was really interested in really avant-garde stuff, in postmodernism and in the black humorists, and was writing a lot of stuff that he thought was very much in that vein of kind of literature. And then he wrote a really long story, which you can read in the collection The Girl with Curious Hair, called Westward, The Course of Empire Takes Its Way, which is essentially a very long commentary on John Barth's Lost in the Funhouse. And he describes that after he finished that, he kind of felt emptied of anything he had left to contribute from an avant-garde perspective, or that he had sort of emptied out all of what he had to say in that vein and began to shift his focus to something else. And I think that's where some of his other influences come in. The stuff like Carver, the stuff like Flannery O'Connor, you know, the stuff like Steinbeck when he's not beating his drum. Those are sort of modernist writers that were all, the thing that kind of unites a lot of them is they were all trying to tell a very real experience that people had. And so I think that that's where Wallace pulls some of the sort of work that he does, especially in Infinite Jest and The Pale King, about narrating the very real experience that a lot of people in America have. And of course, with the influence from the black humorists and from the postmodernists and the experimentalists, that's where all of the other kind of big encyclopedic stuff comes in. So even though he kind of views himself as having moved past it, that influence is certainly there, and I think it's used in a very effective way in his writing.
Yeah, I think I mentioned it to you while I was reading it for the first time, and we'll talk more about it when we get to the actual book itself, but there were sections in there where it was the description of what was happening to a character was so real.
Yeah.
It's almost unsettling at times because it is so accurately portrayed.
Yeah.
But it's part of what makes it really, really good is it allows for this connection that you don't really always get from fiction.
Yeah, very true.
So moving into some of the major themes of his career, a lot of, especially Infinite Jest, was concerning rebelling against at what would be at the time modern television. He had a really critical view of how TV was presented and structured at that time, and I don't disagree with it at all. While there were definitely good and well-written shows being produced at the time, a majority of what was coming out was very color by number, just sort of variations on a theme, and didn't really provide much in the way of challenging an audience or doing anything that might be unconventional. Obviously you had your shows like Twin Peaks, you had some other, you know, sitcoms like Seinfeld, shows like The Simpsons that were kind of breaking that ground, but for the most part a lot of what was out at that time was just, you know, variations on whatever already existed. They were spinoffs of shows that were already there, or they were, you know, playing with the same formula. That necessarily hasn't gone away in recent times, but I think the prevalence of better written and better produced television has sort of come more into prevalence, and I think you could probably point at the success of a book like Infinite Jest and writers like Wallace for that being able to happen. I think without that book and without that sort of recognition of his work, we wouldn't have shows like Atlanta, Curb Your Enthusiasm, the drama shows like The Wire and maybe like Deadwood and things like that are a lot more ambitious in their storytelling and aren't really afraid to play with structure and narrative and how things are done in a television setting. I found a really interesting quote from him where he says, "I want to convince you." This is I should back up and say this is from an essay he wrote called E Unibus Plurum Television in U.S. Fiction, which was published in 93. He says, "I want to convince you that irony, poker face, silence, and fear of ridicule are distinctive of those features of contemporary U.S. culture of which cutting-edge fiction is a part, that enjoy any significant relation to the television whose weird, pretty hand has my generation by the throat. I'm going to argue that irony and ridicule are entertaining and effective, and that at the same time they are agents of a great despair and stasis in U.S. culture, and that for aspiring fictionists they pose terrifically vexing problems." Wallace is on record, I think, numerous times talking about his love of David Lynch. And I believe he was on the set of Lost Highway. Is that right?
Yeah. He wrote an essay about it.
Yeah. So it's clear. And I see a lot of Lynch's influence in, especially in Infinite Jest and Pale King, that sort of black humor that you were talking about, the unconventional structuring of things, the sort of dreaminess of certain passages that he has. All of that is definitely inspired by Lynch, and it's clear that he admired his work. And you know, like I said, I think that not necessarily just because of Infinite Jest, but I think because of the success of that book and the authors who were able to find more readers as a result of the success of that book, that led to a sort of expansion of those, for lack of a better term, the prestige television shows. But then at the same time, you know, there's always going to be your Big Bang Theories. There's always going to be your whatever the other popular CBS, anything on CBS, I think at this point is yeah. just that sort of cut and dry variation on a theme sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's also important to recognize, too, that what David Foster Wallace was concerned with, not just from a standpoint of television's over-reliance on irony and sort of easily digestible material, was also just general consumption as a whole. And that is something that has gone from being kind of transposed on television as onto social media. A lot of what he will talk about in Infinite Jest as we go through the actual book, but then also that he'll talk about in that essay you quoted and in a lot of other writing and interviews of the time contemporary to Infinite Jest, is sort of the ease with which one can sit down and consume something like television for hours and hours on end, and how that affects the brain, how that affects your ambition in life, how that affects what your interests are, how that affects your decision making. And a lot of those things that he will talk about in either the book itself or in those secondary sort of interviews and sources that you can go to is a lot more applicable to social media and the internet age. It was just that he was right. He was writing about this concern too early for it to be really, yeah. For it to be really relevant to the technology that was sort of coming. So certainly when you read those elements or when we get into the television stuff, understand that it was the form and function that he was associated with at the time, but that it is not necessarily pigeonholed to just that type of technology.
Yeah, and then really the other two major themes that he would play with, and again, this kind of goes back to the Lynchian aspect of his work, the sort of contrasts that exist in the world, between whether it's between the beautiful and the grotesque, between happiness and boredom. Those two especially play out a lot in Infinite Jest, with the various storylines that are kind of interwoven within there. And I think without getting too far ahead of ourselves and really diving more into the structure of the book, but the sort of cyclical nature of the way the story is structured and how those dualities kind of play out between certain characters and come back to circle around to themselves or circle around to the opposite end of itself is really an interesting and very well executed way of approaching that book. And I'm sure that those issues of contrast also probably appear a lot in his nonfiction, especially from the sounds of, you know, his, what you were describing, what is it, Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, that sort of self-diagnosing or self-understanding of previous versus current self and all that kind of stuff. So it's definitely something that he worked with through most of his career.
Absolutely. And then, you know, we'll get into this in a second, but I would say that sincerity and earnestness would be,
yes, yeah,
would be one of those, especially of his late career. Yeah. Of course, those being the themes of his most major novel and of his kind of career as a whole being important, they also carried over into his nonfiction. And one of the other things that David Foster Wallace wrote a lot of was essays. In fact, often you'll hear people say that if you're intimidated by Infinite Jest, or if you want to get more into the rhythm of the way that he specifically writes before tackling a 1,300-page book, that his essays would actually be the right place for you to start. And I don't disagree with that. His essays are just as engaging, just as funny, just as insightful as Infinite Jest is, but in smaller, compacted forms that, despite their size, really turn a mirror up to the reader to consider their own opinions, their own sort of state of mind, or their own perspective in the same way that a book like Infinite Jest does. He has two major essay collections. Those are not his only essay collection. Those two essay collections are A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, which consists of essays that were largely written contemporaneously with the composition of Infinite Jest. So it came out after Infinite Jest, but a lot of the essays that he was writing were pieces that he was doing for hire for magazines that largely have to do with experiential experiential essays that he was hired to write, is the best way that I can think of to describe it, where a magazine basically said, like, we want David Foster Wallace's perspective on a luxury cruise, which is the sort of titular essay of A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. Or we want David Foster Wallace's perspective on the Maine Lobster Festival, which is the titular essay for Considered the Lobster, his other major essay collection. Or, you know, David Foster Wallace in another essay goes to the county, the state fair in Illinois. In another essay, he goes to the set of Lost Highway. In another essay, he goes to the AVN Video Awards in Las Vegas. So there's a lot of experiential essays there where he is giving an analysis of a certain type of American life that is sort of very easily connected to and roped into elements of Infinite Jest. And then there are some of those other essays that are more academic in nature, like the E Unibus Plurum essay, which is about television and irony and U.S. fiction and all of the stuff that we've kind of covered in detail about his sort of development as a writer. That essay can really be used as a Rosetta Stone in a lot of cases to some of his later writing, particularly from Infinite Jest forward. In a similar way to how Westward, that long novella at the end of Girl with Curious Hair, can kind of be used as a Rosetta Stone for his development as a writer. And really, those essays, again, as I've said, are kind of a microscopic version of what Infinite Jest does. He is sort of asking himself and the reader, what is it that these people are doing? What is it that I'm doing? And what is it that makes it so American? What is so American about that in quality? And then the other essays that he has written are sometimes about tennis. He himself, as is a very important sort of subject matter to Infinite Jest, he himself was a tennis player when he was younger. He remained a tennis fan through his life. So there are a number of different tennis essays that you can read in those collections. Some of which are about tennis specifically, some of which are about the industry of like celebrity memoirs. There is one particular essay about, I don't remember her name right now, but he reads a sort of celebrity ghostwritten book, you know, that athletes put out all the time, of this one youngish woman who was playing tennis that he used to be like a pretty big fan of. And just, it would appear as though his disappointment was so immeasurable that he needed to write a critical essay of it for a magazine is really the way that it comes across. But even in those moments where he's talking about something like tennis, which is not going to be directly of interest to everybody, you still find that he's able to mine some kind of deeper insight out of it. You know, in that case, it's how do these books that are written by celebrities or supposedly written by celebrities even come into being? He's got another one about John McCain. He was not a particularly political person, but as he got older, politics became something that he was more interested in. And that essay about John McCain called Up Simba is very good. It's a very interesting sort of take on John McCain's status as a politician at that time in history. He also has another sort of longish essay that he wrote with Mark Costello about rap music. It's not very good. You can skip that. that might be the one thing that David Foster Wallace has written other than his early philosophical writing before he kind of switched to being a fiction student that I would say is really not worth your time. If you're looking for kind of a lot of these themes, either if you're just hungry for more after finishing the book once this podcast is over, or if you find the prospect of Infinite Jest kind of a bit daunting, which is totally understandable, those essays, particularly the ones that are collected in Consider the Lobster and A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, are an excellent place to go. There's a reason why it's such a popular recommendation, and it's a recommendation for very good reason.
I kind of want to read the rap thing now. Just as a, is it that bad?
Like, it's not racist or anything, but it's just, it's very clear that it is an essay on rap music's emergence from, like, urban environments written from the perspective of a white person in the early 2000s.
Okay.
Like, it just comes across as, like, not particularly, it just comes across a little bit, like, ignorant, you know, in the sense of just, like, I find this, because, like, it's not every day, I understand why he wanted to write it, right? Like, it's not every day that a new genre of music appears, right? Like, that's a pretty rare thing, and especially rap music, I would say, is the last genre of music to appear in any significant way in, like, not only Dave Foster Wallace's lifetime, but, like, yours and my lifetime as well.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Like maybe something like hyperpop comes along, but that isn't an entire category of music. That's like a subgenre of electronic music.
Yeah.
So I can understand why, in seeing, like, oh my God, this is like a whole new category of music that's coming along, having like an anthropological interest in that. Unfortunately, it's just it's not good. like you know, you don't need to publish everything that you think about. And there are significantly better books or essays about the development of hip hop that have come out since then. Some of which have been written by white people, but most of which have been written by people of color.
if anyone is curious to read really good essays on hip hop, anything Hanif Abdurraqib has written is fantastic.
Yeah,
he did a whole book on Tribe Called Quest that's absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely true. A lot of the themes that are present in the essays and that are present in Infinite Jest and that have come out of the broader topics that he was interested in writing about, especially as it relates to sort of a vision that he lays out in E Unibus Plurum, has later been called post-postmodernism, which is a mouthful and absurd, in my opinion. So I prefer its other term, which is new sincerity. And I have two quotes here for this. First is going to be kind of his critique of postmodernism, and then the other is going to be kind of what he proposes is the idea of what you could do in its place that I think David Foster Wallace himself would then go on to do. So these quotes come from this period where he was analyzing, television, and he was analyzing postmodernism, and then also just kind of irony and sarcasm and other sort of literary elements of that ilk. So this first quote is, "For me, the last few years of the postmodern era have seemed a bit like the way you feel when you're in high school and your parents go on a trip and you throw a party. You get all your friends over and throw this wild, disgusting, fabulous party. For a while it's great, free and freeing, parental authority gone and overthrown, a cat's away, let's play Dionysian revel. But then time passes and the party gets louder and louder and you run out of drugs and nobody's got any more money for drugs and things get broken and spilled and there's cigarette burns on the couch and you're the host and it's your house too and you gradually start wishing your parents would come back and restore some fucking order in your house. It's not a perfect analogy, but the sense I get of my generation of writers and intellectuals or whatever it is that it's 3 a.m. and the couch has several burn holes and somebody's thrown up in the umbrella stand and we're wishing the revel would end. The postmodern founder's patricidal work was great. Patricide produces orphan. And no amount of revelry can make up for the fact that writers my age have been literary orphans throughout our formative years. We're kind of wishing some parents would come back. And of course, we're uneasy about the fact that we wish they'd come back. I mean, what's wrong with us? Are we total pussies? Is there something about authority and limits we actually need? And then, the uneasiest feeling of all, as we start gradually to realize that parents, in fact, aren't ever coming back, which means we're going to have to be the parents. So, to kind of put that in a more digestible context, postmodernism, people like Pynchon, Gaddis, Barth, you know, DeLillo to a certain extent, and you know, Coover, people of that era of the 60s and 70s, the black humorists that deconstructed the concept of even what a novel could be in a lot of cases. You know, Gaddis wrote J.R. J.R. is a book that is entirely in dialogue. there's not a single descriptive element of that book. It's all dialogue. Pynchon, sort of with the creation of the mega encyclopedic novel. You know, a lot of DeLillo stuff where he's deconstructing real history, similar to Pynchon. A lot of these people offered a critique that was necessary. As a fan of postmodern writing, I'm by no means saying that this stuff is all worthless. But what they did was they provided a critique to elements of culture and history that had reigned supreme for a long time, that, you know, things were great. It's all been the Gilded Age. The modern world is beautiful and perfect and is built on good structures and good foundations, and you know, look at how easy it is to get a job with a white picket fence and your kids and all of that. That kind of mentality of an Eisenhower America that kind of started with the development of the Industrial Revolution. A lot of these people were interested in poking holes in that, rightly so, and in critiquing and introducing irony and sarcasm and you know, for lack of a better term, like sardonic writing as a whole. And then they were also interested in deconstructing how these things are created. And, you know, I think that authors like Pynchon do, especially in their later work, provide counterpoints to the critiques, where, you know, we've talked a lot about how Pynchon basically says time and time again that, like, yes, the world is a nightmare, and yes, it's a nightmare because of forces and elements beyond your control, but you have some influence on your direct sort of peers or your family or your friends, mm-hmm. and you can help to reverse that tide in ways through small acts, right? So, like, you know, later Pynchon, I think, gets into some additional content beyond just critiquing or pointing out how shitty everything is. But you also have to remember that he was gone for most of the time that David Foster Wallace was being educated and learning how to write and learning how to make cultural critiques. And the same thing is kind of true of a lot of these postmodern writers. They had either big gaps in their publishing history, or by the time they had moved into writing other stuff, the people that they had influenced had already graduated college or had already had those kind of formative years, you know, come and gone. And then, as happens in every industry, you know, some fashion icon from some big designer house picks a color that's really good and does like a whole collection with it. And then 10 years later, you know, the clothes in JCPenney have that color, that designer or cut. Same thing is true with everything. So the kind of critique and the kind of irony inherent to a lot of these postmodern writers' work eventually gets filtered down to the culture in other ways. TV at the time was a big thing for David Foster Wallace, obviously, but even advertising, the critique and the irony and the cynicism of a lot of that stuff that was very popular in the 60s and 70s eventually filtered through to everything. Deadpool might be the biggest sort of evocation of the stuff that started in the 60s and 70s, if there's ever been a more worthless character in the history of comic books. But, you know, it was reaching a point where it was just, you know, poking fun or poking holes in things without providing any sort of counterbalance, without providing any sort of replacement, without actually helping anybody figure out how to reverse the tides of that or to make meaning in their life. You know, like you can be sarcastic and you can be ironic and you can point, you know, at things and poke fun at them, of course. But if that's all you're doing constantly, eventually you're going to become pretty empty. Because a lot of that stuff is really devoid of meaning in a sense that it doesn't replace anything. It just tears down what's already there. And so David Foster Wallace was interested in trying to figure out what the replacement would be. That now that we've torn down the kind of idols of the government and a sort of popular culture prior to this era, now that we've torn down our illusions as it relates to the American family and 40-hour you know, work weeks and your career and all that. Now that we've deconstructed all of that and seen how all of that shit is useless or is, you know, somewhat of a myth. What do we do now? Like, so the world's a mess. What do we do with that?
Yeah.
And this is where he kind of begins to develop this idea, particularly in that television essay, but then through his writing. There's a quote here from that essay that is: "The next real literary rebels in this country might well emerge as some weird bunch of anti-rebels, born oglers who dare to break away from ironic watching, who have the childish gall to actually endorse single entendre value, who treat old, untrendy human troubles and emotions in U.S. life with reverence and conviction, who eschew self-consciousness and fatigue. These anti-rebels would be outdated, of course, before they even started. Too sincere, clearly repressed, backward, quaint, naive, anachronistic. Maybe that'll be the point. Why they'll be the next real rebels. Real rebels, as far as I can see, risk things. They risk disapproval. The old postmodern insurgents risked the gasp and squeal. Shock, disgust, outrage, censorship, accusations of socialism, anarchism, nihilism. The new rebels might be the ones willing to risk the yawn, the rolled eyes, the cool smile, the nudged ribs, the parody of gifted ironists, the how banal, accusations of sentimentality, melodrama, credulity, willingness to be suckered by a world of lurkers and starers who fear gaze and ridicule above imprisonment without law. Who knows?" I also love that he ends this very kind of impassioned plea for this with just, who knows? I could be crazy. But that is very much what I think his writing came to represent. There are some people who would argue that he eventually turned away from that. They use his short story collection Oblivion as an example of this. Oblivion's very dark. I think a lot of that has to do with his worsening mental health. The Kenyon College commencement speech that he gave, and then he's very famous for, entitled "This Is Water," is one of the last things that he ever did, and that is very much, in my opinion, a reaffirmation of this statement that he makes in his essay on television, that he is committed to this idea of it is important what you pay attention to, it is important to what you choose to put your faith in and your belief in, and how that affects the way that you conduct yourself is the business of being a human. You know, I would say Kurt Vonnegut put it best when he said that we are the things that we pretend to be, so mm-hmm. Be careful what you pretend to be.
Yep.
And that really comes to define Wallace's writing in Infinite Jest. Infinite Jest has all of those hallmarks of postmodernism that we've talked about in this sort of overview. It also is a very deeply sincere book that speaks extensively on psychic pain, on depression, on drug use, you know, on short-term gain versus the sacrifice of long-term happiness. It is a book that deeply, deeply, deeply is interested in how lonely it is to be an American in the 21st century, and has only gained relevance the longer we've gone down the sort of pipeline that we've continued to go. And it is a book that, if experienced, I hesitate to say correctly, but if experienced in the way Wallace, I believe, intended to be experienced, should cause the reader to ask themselves at the end, am I happy? Mm-hmm. And if I am happy, then why? And what have I done to get myself there? And if the answer is no, then why am I unhappy? That is, I think, really what he is trying to do with that book. And in The Pale King, which of course we can only read a portion of, it would appear as though he was trying to take those same themes, those same ideas, those same questions, but put it within the context of reconciling yourself to the day-to-day boredom and work of being an adult. And so all of his writing from this point forward is very, very sincere, very honest, and does very much lean into a depiction or analysis of certain ways that people live and how they live and why they live that way. And it has come to influence and define the careers of some people. I would say that New Sincerity is still, I still think it's in the future as far as a broad kind of demographic interest is concerned, because I think that we're still kind of shuttering off the, I don't want to say shackles, but the influence of something like postmodernism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, irony is very satisfying in the moment, and sarcasm and cynicism is very satisfying in the moment. It is oftentimes, though, a meal that will leave you hungry in the long term. And it is not unlike drugs in that regard. And I think that as we get further down sort of the pipeline of social media and of, you know, burned out dopamine receptors and attention spans, the more people are going to start to turn in that direction. And I think it's already beginning to happen. There are a lot of people who are deliberately trying to reduce their screen time now. A lot of people who are deliberately kind of trying to step backwards in time as it relates to technology. Reading as a hobby is continuing to get more popular because of how people are feeling in the sort of modern media age. So I think that it's a little bit of a ways away where there's going to be a lot more people contributing to this as a literary concept, but that isn't to say that there is nobody. Jonathan Franzen is commonly associated with this movement. Him and David Foster Wallace were very close friends through the entirety of sort of David Foster Wallace's career. Jonathan Franzen has written several books, whether you like them or not. I know that he is often a divisive figure. He has written a number of books that are about the sort of experiences and lives of individual sort of normal people. You know, the Corrections is a book about a just sort of normal family experiencing a crisis. Crossroads, his most recent novel, is about just sort of a one singular couple, living their life at a particular moment in American history. Freedom, his most famous book, is also about something, things that are on their face pretty banal, you know, bird watching and domestic living in America. Marilynne Robinson has sometimes been associated with it in her books like Gilead, that are about family dynamics and sort of intergenerational, not always trauma, but intergenerational experiences and how we pass things down from one generation to the next. Zadie Smith, I think, is a perfect example of a contemporary writer who does this, where she is just very interested in analyzing why people do what they do. And Zadie Smith is very open about her influence coming, a lot of influence coming from David Foster Wallace. She, I don't have the quote to hand, but I think that at one point she said that if there is any one singular author who has influenced her worldview more than any other, it's David Foster Wallace. And her books are excellent that I would highly recommend everyone read. Dave Eggers is another one who is often associated with David Foster Wallace and New Sincerity, and for good reason. He writes a lot. I can't say that I've read all of his work, but a lot of his work deals again with just very honest portrayals of people who are trying to accomplish something or who are living a particular kind of way. Michael Chabon is another big one in this regard, where he writes these kind of, in some cases, big encyclopedic novels like Cavalier and Clay or like the Yiddish Policeman's Union, but that end up just coming down to human experiences and human acts and why people do what they do. There are also examples in film and television. The work particularly of, of Michael Schur, who wrote his graduate thesis on David Foster Wallace and Thomas Pynchon, and actually holds the film rights to Infinite Jest. He bought the film rights to Infinite Jest specifically so that no one would make an Infinite Jest film.
I was
going to
ask if that was why.
that is the entire
good for him
reason why he did that. His work, whether it be his early writing that he did on some episodes of The Office, is certainly tinged with that that sort of perspective. But I would say particularly The Good Place, a show that is funny and is a little bit deconstructionist, but still is at its heart a show about moral philosophy and about why people make the decisions that they make and kind of what binds us together as human beings. So there are individual examples of this that you can find. I think a big resurgence in, I don't like the word, but autofiction can also be traced to New Sincerity or post-postmodernism. It's a case where these younger writers who are being put into that kind of camp of autofiction are often writing about their own experiences or about what it is like to try and be a human right now in this present moment and how challenging that can be. As a random aside, what the fuck does autofiction mean? Is Proust autofiction? I don't like this idea that has come up, especially in the last like 5 to 10 years, that writing autofiction automatically means that like the stuff you're writing is sort of like puerile and not as good as other stuff. Writing about their own experiences in life has been a thing since someone first started writing a novel.
I mean, if someone's own personal life doesn't color the things that they're writing about, I don't know what they're doing.
I'm sure that whoever originally wrote down the Epic of Gilgamesh put something in that from their own life. That's just what it means to be a writer. So that is sort of the broad outlines of his philosophy as a writer and what came to kind of become identified as distinctly Wallacean from a philosophical perspective. There are obviously styles of his writing that you can point out as far as grammar, as it relates to composition, that are distinctly Wallacean. But I think that especially his late career after Infinite Jest, that's really what he's all really concerned with. And you know, when it comes down to that kind of turning point with the composition of the novel itself, it's interesting because he had reached a point in his career where he didn't have to worry too much about the kind of publish or perish kind of paradigm of being in academia, because he was a college student he was a college professor at the time. And so he was publishing enough essays or magazine pieces or short stories that his kind of position in academia was secured. And this is really what turned him towards, what am I interested in writing about? You know, like if I can choose one thing to kind of put together into a novel, or what am I interested in really trying to articulate, what would that be? And I think that that's really where Infinite Jest kind of starts. It is a pure evocation of the things that David Foster Wallace was interested in at the time, from a perspective of how his mindset was developing and how his perspective was changing as it related to both the literary landscape but also the landscape of just living as a human being. he tried to start the novel in the 80s, if I remember correctly, and found that just there was no solid inroad to it, and he just needed more time to develop it and mull over what the idea was. There are some early portions of it that you can look at in his archive, which is available at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas in Austin. And it isn't really until the early 90s that that he really gets going on the book. And it isn't really until almost 1994 that he has like a working draft of the novel. It's around the end of 1993. He will be quoted in multiple interviews as having said, "All I know about this book is this is the best writing I could do between 1994 and 1996 in trying to describe some of what the book itself was about. And a lot of excerpts got dropped in various journals, of course, sort of a lot of the standard places that these go to. Harper's, The New Yorker published a piece of it. Conjunctions, that was an old magazine that I wish was still around because they published so much interesting stuff. You know, the Iowa Review, things like that are places where he initially dropped chapters of it, and hype around the novel began to build in a very real way. Eventually, when he finished his first draft, it was, if I'm not mistaken, 1600 or 1800 pages long. It was very, very, very long. Evidently, from that original draft that he turned into Michael Peach of Little Brown, there were whole characters and subplots that just got cut. Then that it either was, you know, defined as being unnecessary, or that could be cut without any kind of overall effect on the overarching structure of the book. And so Michael Peach would edit not just this book, but pretty much most of the rest of his long fiction after that. The two of them had a very, very good relationship. Although apparently what happened when he turned his first draft of it into Little Brown is Michael Peach told him, like, "This is excellent. This is maybe one of the best books that I have ever read. However, we do need to make it shorter. But I want you to know that I think this is a work of genius." And in multiple different interviews, David Foster Wallace has described the process by which they cut the book down as being incredibly excruciating and involving several letters back and forth between the two of them over, "Why specifically does this need to be cut? I need you to explain to me why it is that this is unimportant." And then Michael Peach would tell him, and then he would say, "Well, I actually think this is very important for XYZ reason." And then it would go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth like that until eventually David Foster would say, "Okay, fine, we'll cut it. I guess it's unnecessary." And apparently they did this until, you know, up to 400 pages of material were cut. There are some sort of, I don't even know what to call it. Like, there are some people who have posted on forums or written articles about how they were friends with David Foster Wallace and he gave them a look at the manuscript before it was published, and so they have some insight to what was cut from those 400 pages. I don't think that's a particularly interesting thing to think about. So, you know, just know that it was longer. It became shorter through the normal kind of editing process that any of these books come out with, and you know, eventually it is released in 1996 to as it pretty much instant acclaim. It was something that was not only marketed heavily before it was released, but by the time it actually came around to being released, it was an event in a way that I would say that the closest thing that I've seen to that in my lifetime is James by Percival Everett. You would think that that book is a psyop based upon the amount of awards that it won and based on the amount of people that you see reading it on the street and how much acclaim it got. It was an event like that. Uh-huh. I tend to agree with Stephen Moore when he reviewed it in the Review of Contemporary Fiction and called it a profound study of the postmodern condition. I think that is a excellent description of that book as a whole. You know, there are some critics, as with anything, that gave mixed opinions on it, but broadly it was a massive success, and people instantly sort of saw it for the work of genius that it was. And he would go on a very long sort of book tour for it, and by the time he had finished that up, it was expected to win sort of every major literary award of the year, and it won none of them. I still don't entirely know how. But the fact that it didn't win the Pulitzer, it didn't win the National Book Award, it didn't win the Booker, it didn't win any of these huge prizes is very, very unexplainable to me. I would guess that it didn't win any of them for the exact same reason that Gravity's Rainbow did not win the Pulitzer Prize. And it was because most of the people on the jury didn't read it, or at the very least didn't read it in its entirety.
Unreal. Fucking unreal. I hate this shit.
It is pretty crazy. As far as like one other note on its composition, he initially had a very specific idea for the cover in mind. And it was meant to be an image of Fritz Lang on the set of Metropolis directing a group of extras. It is unclear what photo specifically, but there are not that many photos of the set of Metropolis, much less Fritz Lang directing on Metropolis. So there are a couple that people have tracked down where he is sort of standing on a stage, yelling out of a very comically large bullhorn, and there's sort of a group of people kind of collected clamoring up at him, or stood sort of in formation listening to his instructions. The fact that nobody has released a subsequent edition with that photo used as the cover is a source of great consternation for me. Because David Foster Wallace hated the clouds. He didn't think they really had anything to do with the book. I understand. It does feel just sort of like a random choice. But it does tend to be what continuously is used as the cover for the book. And I think that I understand why he wasn't granted his request at the time of original release, because, you know, oftentimes authors don't get to do that unless they're like Stephen King.
Yeah.
But, you know, especially in the wake of his passing and the continued import of the novel, feels like you could give him that one.
Right, especially for like, the anniversary now? Like, come on.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, they even did like a cover art contest for the 25th anniversary edition. And not only did they not just choose that, but I think the one they ended up choosing was the least interesting of all of the applicants that I saw turned in. So yeah, that's sort of just a little bit on the composition of the book. One of my favorite kind of comments from Michael Peach on the composition of the book that he said to David Foster Wallace, that David Foster Wallace then relayed in an interview, is apparently one of his first reactions to the book was that he said it felt like an object that had been dropped from a great height, in reference to the structure, and then it was like a shattered pane of glass, which I think is just an absolutely perfect way to describe the way that book is sort of laid out, if you're not going to use the actual geometric shape that it's laid out in. So yeah, that's a bit about kind of his philosophy, as well as the composition of the book that we're going to be talking about. It has not been adapted, but it has been tried, right, Cody?
Yes. So I learned some rather interesting attempts to do this here. So British playwright Ken Campbell, who actually is a pretty big name in the theater world, or I should say was, he died in 2008. He had, so he, I should back up and say, this is the guy who I think we talked about this at some point, he did adapt the Illuminatus trilogy for stage in the 1970s.
Oh, interesting.
A 9-hour play. Don't know that I have the patience for that. I couldn't even finish the book. but he did it, so good for him. He had planned on trying to have 1,000 performers who would each be paid $23 to take part in a week-long adaptation of it. This is essentially Synecdoche, New York.
Yeah.
If it were done in real life and was an adaptation of Infinite Jest. It obviously, I don't think you could feasibly do that. It would be really interesting. I think it would almost be more interesting as a, and I'm kind of curious now that I've made that connection, like how much of Synecdoche, New York is actually maybe inspired by that attempt to create such a massive interpretation of something as a living artifact. I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, it didn't happen, obviously. But then a German theatrical company called Hebel am Ufer produced a 24-hour avant-garde open-air theater adaptation in 2012. Mm-hmm. Not sure if there's any actual like video of that. I kind of doubt it given the runtime of that, but that would have been an interesting thing to see. Finnish radio, YLE, adapted it for radio in January of 2023. They broadcasted over 6 episodes. I kind of think that might be the only way you could pull something like that off is to do it as an audio sort of thing. But even then, knowing all the end notes and the errata and all that kind of stuff, like, that's where I'm like, I don't know. That would be really hard to pull off. But then there's actually a really interesting fan-made trailer that came out in 2024 that you actually sent my way.
Yeah.
Not too long ago, that was actually really kind of cool.
Not bad.
Really kind of worked, but again, it's only a 2.5-minute thing. So I think that's a big reason why it worked, but it was very well done. Yeah. I will have a link to that in the show notes for anyone who's interested in watching that. It was very, very well done.
It really felt like early YouTube to me in that.
Yes. Yes.
The acting in it is not particularly good. But it is very clearly something that is made by a group of people who just love this one particular thing. And it is actually, the cinematography in that trailer is actually quite
surprisingly good,
quite excellent. in a way that the acting is not always. But I in all of my sort of autistic obsession with this book and David Foster Wallace, I somehow had not come across that until I had sent.
But yeah, I want to end that part of this by just saying that I don't generally like to dismiss something as being unadaptable, but I don't think this is an adaptable novel.
No.
I think it has to be left in the format in which it exists, and that's okay. I think that's where people get tripped up, is that they think that if it's not something that can be adapted to a different medium, it's not worth the investment of time, and I highly disagree with that. I think that some things are just meant for the medium in which they're produced, and they just need to be left there.
Yeah.
I know that's not how society and how the Hollywood machine works, but I just, you know, some things are just better left untouched.
Yeah, and I think part of that are some of the sort of major themes of the book, which maybe you can get into a little bit. I think that, you know, you can film individual scenes, but so much of that book is directly analyzing different elements of history or different elements of the history of one particular character's life, or is an evocation of like an internal monologue that makes it hard to adapt things thematically to a film medium. I'm sure, you know, for example, there's a Decemberists music video that adapts the Eschaton game.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, that music
thing.
That music video is actually directed by Mike Schur.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. Like, so like that is a very faithful reproduction of the scene. it does not tell you anything that scene tells you in the book itself.
Yeah.
So I think when it comes to the actual themes of the book, that is the hardest part of it to really get across in trying to tackle an adaptation.
Yeah, and especially one that touches on as many different themes as it does. Obviously, kind of at the forefront of a lot of it is addiction, consumption of media, depression and anxiety, which is something that we will get into. That goes back to that discussion on the hyper-realism of certain scenes. His portrayal of people who suffer from depression and anxiety is so spot on as someone who has suffered from both my entire life.
Yeah.
And who he did as well. It's very clear that he had a good grasp on how to define really those moments of struggle. But there's also a lot of hope in it. So it, you know, again, that sort of duality that we were talking about earlier. Corporatization plays a huge part in this. If anyone has not read the book before, you will notice that almost immediately with the naming of the years that exist within the time frame of the book. Linguistics is huge. Hal, one of the main characters, is a walking dictionary, literally. that's a huge part of it. Absentee parents, which was a big part of the kind of 80s and 90s, was that sort of turnkey,
the invention of the latchkey
family
kid.
Thank you, latchkey kid. Which I was one.
I was one as well.
Yeah. So, tennis is huge. I've never been a huge tennis fan, but I thoroughly enjoy his descriptions of tennis in this book. The academic pressure that's put on adolescents, again, something that I can highly relate to. There are connections to Hamlet, obviously, in the title of the book. Critics have made connections to the Odyssey and the Brothers Karamazov. Monty Python's Funniest Joke in the World sketch was brought up as a reference that may have had connection to a certain piece of media that is consumed in the book, and I can absolutely see him being inspired by that based on the sketch and knowing his appreciation of that type of writing and humor. It would not surprise me at all if that played a very vital role in his sort of working the way that scene or scenes played out. And then Robert Nozick's Experience Machine, which I was unfamiliar with coming into this episode, but read about it a little bit. It's really interesting. It's essentially an attempt to refute ethical hedonism by imagining a choice made between everyday reality and an apparently preferable simulated reality. Mm-hmm. So it's a really interesting thought experiment. I would recommend, I'll leave a link to the Wikipedia article on it in the show notes, because that's something we could probably go on for an hour about. But it's really interesting, especially in context with the book and what it's working with and how it's exploring these characters. It makes a lot of sense that would be a huge influence on it as well.
Now, if all of this sort of table setting was not enough for you, there are other things that you can do to kind of fill your time between now and next month when we get into the actual book proper. There are a number of interviews that are available for you to listen to on YouTube. He really, I don't know why, but he really benefited from a lot of people taping the radio because there are numerous collections of his interviews that you can go listen to on YouTube. The most famous one that I would always recommend people start with before even getting into the interviews would be the recording that someone made of his commencement speech at Kenyon, This Is Water. I think that This Is Water is something that is, it's not only just like the best commencement speech I think anyone will ever give, to the point that a college professor at a liberal arts university here in Wisconsin was going to be giving the commencement speech to the university that she actually teaches at, and was asking her friends on social media, like, does anyone have any ideas for like good commencement speeches to listen to? I've already listened to This Is Water, like preempted it before anyone even suggested it. So it's not just a great speech, but it's also, again, just like a really good evocation of his philosophy, that he is attempting to use his writing, starting with Infinite Jest, to be about. But from there, there's an excellent interview that he did with Charlie Rose in 1997 that gives you all sorts of insights into his development as a writer, into the composition of Infinite Jest, and kind of what he was interested in doing at the time. His final interview that he ever gave in 2003 is also something that you can watch. He gave it to a German television station. I believe ZDF was the name of that television station. It's an hour and a half long, and he talks about everything from sort of politics to the decline of reading that he saw, to television, to what it means to be sort of a citizen in the modern age. It's really, really excellent. It was also put into a book in a series called the Last Interview series, where they just sort of type up whatever the last interview a author or musician gave. So you can also read it if you would prefer to do that as opposed to listen to it. There is also a compilation of every single appearance he made on Bookworm over the course of his career that you can listen to, which is excellent. The very first appearance is the one related to Infinite Jest. If you're not familiar with Bookworm, it was a show hosted on Los Angeles Public Radio by someone named Michael Silverblatt, who is sometimes referred to as the world's greatest reader. I don't dispute that title. His insights into not just David Foster Wallace, but everybody he interviewed are really quite something. There's another Charlie Rose appearance that he did along with Jonathan Franzen and Mark Lehner, which is excellent, where they're discussing the sort of future of fiction writing in an age that is sort of being increasingly dominated by easily digestible media, particularly television and movies. There are numerous public radio appearances that he gave that you can listen to. There's one in particular that he did with a radio interviewer named Chris Slyden, I think. It was during the Infinite Jest tour in 96, where that interview, I think, really gets to the heart of, like, why it feels like his generation is so sort of lost or scattered in its motivation. I could keep going for quite a while. There are a lot of interviews that you can listen to him give. There are also segments of David Lipsky's recordings of their weekend together, which would later become the book and although, of course, you end up becoming yourself, which then would later turn into the movie The End of the Tour. You can listen to their conversations directly. You can also read that book for the full sort of transcripts of their conversations. And in that case, you get like a really good insight into a longer form understanding of what he thought Infinite Jest was about. And in the sort of more modern era after his death, there are a couple of different places that you can kind of go. There is no companion book for Infinite Jest directly. So, you know, kind of like what a friend of the show, Brett Beeble, did for Mason and Dixon, that doesn't really exist for Infinite Jest. But there is a Cambridge companion that you can purchase to not Infinite Jest, but David Foster Wallace's work as a whole, where they are really trying to, with the essays in that companion, analyze sort of how we are living in a world that David Foster Wallace envisioned, which I think is particularly germane to Infinite Jest. That was sort of his biggest evocation or analysis of the world that we are living in now. You can also read a number of quarterly, I think it's quarterly, there's a David Foster Wallace Society now, where people write essays on Wallace. And they put out a journal that you can read. They have a convention every single year. And there are numerous essay collections that are put out by different university presses. I don't want to claim to be like the world's foremost expert on David Foster Wallace, but in my experience, a lot of the essays that I have read on Infinite Jest and on his work as a whole are okay. I think the Cambridge Companion is excellent. I think a lot of the work that they're trying to uncover in more so how he was kind of in many ways a prophetic writer is a lot more interesting than some people's interpretations of his career, particularly his late career. As I said, there's a lot of people now who kind of believe that he abandoned the new sincerity idea, and all of the essays related to that, I think, are a real load of crap. And it also it makes up a good chunk of some of that academic material. So, since he is such a still a contemporary writer, I mean, this book is only 30 years old. It's a case where I think maybe just not enough time has passed for a lot of sort of settled scholarship to really become associated with his work as a whole. So that's kind of the other directions you can go. Of course, you could do none of that, and if you want, you could just listen to this podcast and just get my thoughts unfiltered into your ears. Do you have anything else you want to go over, Cody, before we wrap up this introduction to Infinite Jest?
No, other than to say that I'm really excited to get back into it. Like I mentioned, the sort of circularity that exists is something that I didn't discover until my picking it up again for this. Yeah. To be fair, I started it a little bit before we talked about doing this, and then when you suggested it, I was like, all right, well, perfectly good reason to start it back over again. So, I am really, really looking forward to it, and I'm hoping it is enjoyed by everyone as much as they enjoy the coverage that we do of Pynchon, and we bring in some new listeners as well, and that this is something we can continue doing and hopefully have other, you know, things that maybe Luke and Will discuss or that we all four talk about. I just like talking about books.
Yeah, same here. I do also have a minor piece of housekeeping in that my fiance was incredibly cross with me for referring to Michelle Zahner as the Japanese breakfast lady, without giving her the credit that she is due for having written Crying in H-Mart, in the sort of trailer to this series. So, Michelle Zahner, who is given the honor of writing the introduction to the 30th anniversary edition of Infinite Jest, is not just the Japanese breakfast lady. She did write a highly regarded memoir about her, I believe her mother's passing is what the book is.
I think so. I've heard a lot of good things about it.
So she does have literary merit, but I by no means meant to put her down by saying she's the Japanese breakfast lady. She makes excellent music. So I needed to make sure that I corrected that for you, darling, because I know you're going to be listening to this. So I'm sorry. Michelle Zahner is also the writer of Crying in H-Mart. So happy 30th anniversary to Infinite Jest. If you're listening to this on the day that it was released, and we will see you in 1 month to cover the first chunk of the book. As I had mentioned in the sort of trailer for this series that we released, there is not a good way to evenly divide up this book. There's not even really chapters in a traditional sense. There is a sort of icon that marks what might be a chapter, but at no point does he tell you that that's what it means. And then there are page breaks and different things that are demarcated by changes in sort of dates across a variety of years that are in the book. But roughly how this is going to break out is about 100 pages per episode. Sometimes it'll be a little bit more than that. Sometimes it'll be a little bit less than that, but it kind of works out to about 100 in the aggregate. And I must have sent this to you a really, really long time ago because I am still scrolling.
Yeah, there was a breakdown. We had a breakdown of it a while back.
There it is. And you will have a month to read all of this before we talk about it. So this episode is coming out on February 1st. The next episode will come out on March 1st and April 1st and so on and so forth. So for our discussion on March 1st, you will have to read pages 1 through 105. That will be the first chunk that we are talking about. As I believe mentioned in the trailer, pretty much every edition is the same pagination. I have 5 different editions of Infinite Jest. Cody has an edition that I don't have, but all 6 of those collected editions have the same pagination. So it shouldn't matter as far as I'm aware. Apologies if this goes horribly wrong for someone reading it in like Hungarian or something. But there is a page break on page 105. And so we will read up to that page break for the episode next month. And of course, feel free to send us any emails with questions or comments or anything that you think might be appropriate for the conversation of this book as we continue to go on. You can, of course, get a hold of us in a number of different places. The most easy would be mappingthezonepod@gmail.com. You can reach out to us on Blue Sky at PinchonPod. You can, or Mapping the Zone Pod is our Blue yes. Sky. You can reach out to us at PinchonPod on Twitter. We are also available to be got at on YouTube at Mapping the Zone Podcast, as well as Instagram at Mapping the Zone Podcast. If you think our show is worth a dollar, we would love to have it. Please do consider donating to our Ko-Fi. There, just any money you give to us will directly go into paying for the hosting of this program. And of course, all of the episodes of the Pinchon seasons that we've done will go to pay for those costs there. But then any other sort of surprise costs like upgrading equipment for recording and paying just anything it takes to keep this show running. Another way to support us, if you want some merchandise in exchange, would be our spread shop where you can get Mapping This Unrelated t-shirts and stickers and mugs and all sorts of fancy trinkets there. Maybe we'll do something for Infinite Jest to throw in the shop. We've talked about the book enough. So, those are the different ways to get at us and to support us. So until next month, thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.